Jack was glad that they had finally come to the heart of the matter. It seemed Anna was glad, too, because she spoke in the calm, matter-of-fact voice she had used in her laboratory classroom. "I found Dr. Manderston's observations to be similar to my own, but I don't agree with his conclusion that an operation was carried out by person or persons unknown." Mayo leaned forward, his long nose twitching as if he had caught the scent of something interesting.
"The operation was legal?"
"Don't answer that until and unless District Attorney Mayo clarifies what he means by operation," Belmont said.
Mayo inclined his head.
"Would you say that Mrs. Campbell underwent an abortion?"
"I couldn't say that with certainty," Anna said. "It's unclear to me whether she was pregnant in the first place."
"You wouldn't recognize pregnancy at this very early stage upon opening the reproductive organs?"
"If the uterus had been intact, certainly. But the damage was extensive, and at least a day old."
"Then let's say it this way. Did she undergo an attempted abortion?"
Anna looked the man directly in the eye. "In my professional opinion, the procedure in question was meant to interrupt a pregnancy. If there was a pregnancy, when undertaken for that specific purpose, such operations are illegal, as you well know."
Mayo was running a finger back and forth over the tablecloth, as if he had found something etched into the wood that he needed to understand. To Jack, it looked like a mannerism developed to distract and disorient a witness, but he had misread Anna if he thought she was so easily unsettled. Mayo said,
"You have never performed this operation yourself." "Do not answer that," Belmont said sourly. "It's not relevant to the case at hand."
"I agree," Hawthorne said. "And, Dr. Savard, on what point exactly do you disagree with Dr. Manderston's findings?"
"I believe Dr. Manderston was incorrect when he wrote person or persons unknown."
Mayo widened his eyes in mock distress.
"You know who operated on Mrs. Campbell? If you had said so to start with, we wouldn't be sitting here."
Anna looked at Manderston for a long moment, then spoke to him directly. "In my opinion, Mrs. Campbell's injuries were self-inflicted."
Heath gave a startled laugh. "That is utterly ridiculous." "I would say patently impossible," Manderston volunteered.
The coroner raised a brow in Manderston's direction.
"As I understand it, many women perform such operations on themselves, and often with success." "Not in this case," said Manderston. "This was no simple scraping gone bad. The damage was considerable, and the pain would have stopped her."
The coroner looked at Anna.
"Dr. Savard?"
"The pain might well stop a man," Anna agreed. Sophie said, "Desperate women are capable of even worse."
Keith snorted openly. "In your extensive experience, I suppose you've seen worse?"
"I have," Sophie said, "but then I work mostly with the poorest women, and desperation is the rule rather than the exception."
She looked from Manderston to Heath and back again.
"You would have less experience of this kind at your hospital."
"I was practicing medicine before you were born," Heath said, his lip curling.
"Of course," Sophie said, "but in the homes of the rich or in your own clinic."
"Mrs. Campbell was my patient, if I may remind you."
"And she left your care?"
"Because she knew I wouldn't perform the operation she wanted."
"Because she was terrified and knew you didn't care."
"Coroner Hawthorne," Heath barked, "I will not be spoken to this way by a...
He coughed and sputtered as he pushed himself out of his chair.
"Sit down, Dr. Heath," Hawthorne said. "We are almost finished here. I see no option but to convene a coroner's jury to decide if this was accidental suicide or a death following from malpractice."
"Or both,"
Manderston muttered loud enough to be heard throughout the room.
We'll meet on Monday,
Hawthorne went on, ignoring him. Sophie rose immediately and leaned over to Anna, putting a hand on Jack's shoulder to draw him into the conversation.
I must go down to Cap, she said, and get him home and into bed. Will you call later?
Not this evening, Anna said. You are in desperate need of rest, too, Sophie. Let's let Conrad do his work, and we can talk over the weekend. We have until Monday to work out a strategy.
They turned to look to the front of the room, where the attorneys and clerks and coroner were deep in conversation.
What is that about, do you think? Anna asked.
Jack said, Belmont will be insisting on a second autopsy, and no doubt he's arguing about the jurors. In other cases like these, he would want as many doctors as he could get.
He broke off, and Anna took up what he had been reluctant to say. But not in our case. No male physicians, at any rate, to sit in judgment of us.
Then who, Sophie asked, may we suggest names?
I think that you should, Jack said. Give them to Conrad as soon as possible, and let him steer things in that direction.
I'll do that, Anna said to Sophie. You go on to Cap, and give him my love. Tell him Conrad has things well in hand.
I will, Sophie said, though I don't quite believe it myself.
Chapter 24 New York Times, Friday, May 25th, 1883, Evening Edition.
Coroner's jury to examine two women physicians in connection with the death of Janine Campbell. Just one day ago, while the rest of the city enjoyed the fireworks display that closed the ceremonies for the new East River Bridge, an autopsy was performed at the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital. The deceased, Mrs. Janine Campbell, a married lady of respectable family and mother of four small boys, died earlier yesterday. The post-mortem examination revealed evidence of malpractice. The physicians subpoenaed for questioning in connection with this case were Drs. Sophie Verhoeven, who attended Mrs. Campbell at the birth of her fourth son in March, and Dr. Anna Savard, the surgeon on duty when Mrs. Campbell arrived at the New Amsterdam yesterday. The two lady physicians are distant cousins who grew up together on Waverly Place. Sophie Savard Verhoeven, a mulatto, was born in New Orleans and came to New York as an orphan in 1865. Both women are graduates of the Women's Medical School and properly registered at sanitary headquarters. Drs. Savard and Verhoeven met with Coroner Lorenzo Hawthorne at his offices this afternoon, accompanied by their attorney, Conrad Belmont Esquire, to answer questions arising from an autopsy performed by Dr. Donald Manderston of Women's Hospital. Subsequent to that meeting, Coroner Hawthorne announced he will convene a jury. Jurors will decide if Mrs. Campbell's death can be attributed to criminal malpractice on the part of one of the doctors who treated her. Such a finding would cause the doctors to be bound over to the grand jury to determine whether indictments are called for. New York World, Friday, May 25th, 1883. Evening Edition. Mulatto Bride to Face Coroner's Jury. As reported in the early morning edition of The Post, Sophie E. Savard married this morning to Peter Verhoeven Esquire, the wealthy son of one of the city's most noble families, has been instructed to appear before a coroner's jury on Monday. The deceased is Mrs. Janine Campbell, a young woman who was in Dr. Savard Verhoeven's care at the time of her death by malpractice. Also being questioned is Dr. Anna Savard, the last physician to treat the victim on the day of her death. Accordingly, Mr. and Mrs. Verhoeven have postponed their departure for Marseille.
Anna took a cab to the Staten Island Ferry at the foot of Whitehall Street early Saturday morning, where Jack was waiting. He kissed her cheek and took her Gladstone bag and valise, bought tickets, and found seats quickly and without fuss. Anna, ill at ease and out of sorts after a poor night's sleep, took exception. He seemed untouched by the events of the previous day, good and bad both. It set her teeth on edge. When they had settled in for the journey, Anna thought that he would raise the subject of the inquest, and was both relieved and irritated when he did not. Instead, he talked of a letter from his mother and an ongoing rivalry between two sisters-in-law that had to do with what he called tomato gravy. Uncle Alfonso's complaints about the utter lack of logic in the way English was spelled, and Oscar's landlady's dog, who had produced 6 puppies in the middle of the night without uttering a sound. Or maybe, Jack suggested, Oscar's consumption of beer had had something to do with his undisturbed sleep. Comforting, easy conversation that had nothing to do with death or postmortems or the Comstock Act. There was no talk of Sophie or Cap, and really, she reminded herself, hadn't she just this morning wished to have a day she could spend with Jack alone? When there was a pause in his storytelling, Anna pointed something out. "You're trying to rob me of my mood." Jack stretched out his legs and crossed his ankles, put his hands behind his head, and tilted his face to the salt breeze. He grinned without looking at her.
"How am I doing?"
Anna bit back her own smile, but conceded defeat. It was too fine a summer morning to fret over things that could not be changed or even prepared for. It all had to be left to Conrad Belmont, for the moment at least. "Surprisingly well."
"That's a relief. It's bad luck to scowl on your birthday."
Anna closed her eyes and put her head back. "Sophie has been telling tales."
"It's not your birthday?" Anna hummed. "You don't want any presents," she told me. "You dislike birthdays."
"True."
"I like presents," Jack said.
"Is it your birthday?"
"It is not. But if you're not using yours..."
Anna turned toward him. "So what is it you want for your not birthday?"
"I'll think of something," he said.
Then he roused himself to take a wrapped package from his valise, while he talked about progress he had made arranging repairs to the old Greber house. Except he didn't call it the old Greber house, or my new house, or even our new house, but Weeds. The Russo girls had given the new house that very odd name to distinguish it from Aunt Quinlan's, now renamed Roses, as in, "We're going over to Weeds to play," or "They'll be wondering about us at Roses." Without comment or discussion, everyone had taken up the new names. Anna feared that even after Mr. Lee had transformed the neglected garden into a showpiece, the name would stick. In 50 years, quite likely, few people would remember why. He handed her the package wrapped in brown paper.
"Not a birthday present," he said. "Wallpaper samples. My sisters want to know what appeals to you."
Anna unfolded the samples and spread them out on her lap. Huge, fussy sunflowers against a background of maroon and brown, scrolling agapanthus and olive greens and grays, cabbage roses in pink and red rioting over a trellis, interrupted here and there with blue globules that were meant, she thought, to be songbirds. She folded the samples and retied the bundle while she thought. She said, "Do we have to have wallpaper?" He let out a relieved sigh.
"Maybe together we can convince my sisters that we don't. I'd get a headache looking at any of those every day."
"Tell them, never mind, you shouldn't have to speak for me. I'll take them to a friend's house that I admire. Maybe that will be enough."
"Friend?"
She looked at him closely. "You sound surprised."
"Not in the least," he said. "I'm just remembering you told me once that you didn't have many friends."
"It's very rude of you to remember everything I say." She made an effort to sound severe and produced only an indigent huff. "And I do have a few friends. This one's named Lisbeth. Her daughter went to school with us at the Cooper Union. Annika married a Swede and moved back there, but her mother is still here."
"Wait, you and Sophie went to the Cooper Union?" I thought they only taught classes for adults.
The Institute has a class for the children of faculty members. Aunt Quinlan taught drawing and painting, Cap's uncle, Van Troyen, taught engineering, and Annika's father taught mathematics. That's how I met Cap. At a lecture the grown-ups went to hear, before we even started school.
You've never told me much about any of this.
Haven't I? Anna considered. I don't think the stories are anything out of the ordinary. We were overindulged, I suppose, when it came to school. Any curiosity was to be encouraged, and everything was a game, from mathematics to Latin. We took every opportunity to go off on our own to explore. Annika and her brother Niels sometimes joined us. But my point was, I very much like her mother's house. Lisbet is someone I admire greatly. If there's time to go visit, I wonder if your sisters would be shocked.
They might surprise you.
Anna thought, that would be nice. For a long time, they didn't talk at all. And Anna was free to take in the ocean air and the sun on the water and the promise of what just might turn out to be a perfect day. Little by little, she was aware of her mood floating away from her to disappear without a trace. She let out a breath she hadn't realized she had been holding, put her head on Jack's shoulder, and fell asleep. It was such a deep sleep that she was disoriented when he woke her an hour later, his breath on her ear sending a shiver running up and down her spine. He said,
"Vanderbilt's landing, Savard. Rise and shine."
You know, you could call me Anna at this point, she told him as they made their way from the ferry landing to the Stapleton train station. As they walked, she was scanning the shoreline and all the mansions that overlooked the Sound, the homes of men who traveled to Brooklyn or Manhattan by ferry, mornings and evenings.
He said, "You still call me Mezzanotte for the most part?"
"Because I like the sound of it. If your last name were Duzedeker Boimer or Gooch or Quisenberry," she shrugged,
"you would never have talked to me at all."
"Well," she said, stepping neatly away, "of course I would have talked to you, but I couldn't marry someone with the name Duzedeker Boimer. In fact, it's odd that I'm marrying anybody at all. I didn't think I ever would." She was in a lighter mood, even playful. But not far beneath the surface, she was still exhausted. Standing next to him on the platform, she almost swayed in the breeze, blinking owlishly in the bright sun.
"What about Anna Mezzanotte? Do you like the sound of that?"
She jerked and came fully awake. She said. Jack had wondered if this would be an issue, if she would resist taking his name. He hoped he wouldn't have to convince her, because this was one point on which his parents, his father most especially, would balk.
"I have a suggestion," he said before she could think how to respond. "But let's wait until we've found our seats."
As soon as the train jerked its way out of the station, she said, "Your suggestion?"
"As a doctor, you will want to remain Dr. Savard. I understand that. But at home, and when children come along..."
"They would have your last name, of course." Relief flooded her expression. "I thought you would be unhappy about my professional name."
He shook his head, thinking, "Pick your battles." He said, "At home, you're one woman, and at the hospital, another."
She collapsed, boneless, against her seat back, and yawned again. "I don't seem to be able to keep my eyes open."
"Then sleep," he said, leaning a shoulder toward her in invitation. "Anything exciting happens, I'll wake you up."
She laughed, rubbing her cheek against his jacket, as if to find the right spot. "I wonder what would count as exciting on Staten Island. A deer on the tracks." She had other questions about the route. If the train line ran close along Raritan Bay, whether there might be time to walk on the beaches later,
and then she was asleep again without waiting for comment or answers. He put his arm around her to hold her steady against the sway and lurch of the train, and looked up to see that they were being observed by two old women, farmers' wives almost certainly, by their faded sunbonnets and aprons. Watching Anna sleep as attentively as they might have watched a play on the stage, sleep robbed her face of its fierce intelligence and turned her into nothing more or less than a woman in the full blush of her youth at rest, innocent, almost otherworldly. Then the women turned to look out the window, and the moment passed. For a moment, Jack weighed the idea of getting the Times out of his valise, and then remembered the article just under the fold on the front page, where Anna's name figured so prominently. She might not have seen it. He hoped she had not. Even more, he hoped she hadn't seen the Post or any of the other rags that were having such a good time dissecting the Savard women. Tomorrow would be soon enough for all that, or the day after. For today, they were free of everything and everyone. They traveled along Raritan Bay for a while, slow enough to take in long stretches of dunes that relieved and then hid the shore where oystermen were hauling nets. On the horizon, he could just make out boats like smudges of paint shimmering in the sun. According to the train schedule, the journey would take an hour, which Jack soon realized was more a fanciful guess than a statement of fact. He watched passengers amble along to get on and off as if they had never heard the word timetable. At one stop, the conductor sat himself down on a convenient pile of luggage and launched into what looked like a serious conversation with the station master, pausing only to light his pipe. So close to Manhattan, and a different world altogether. Different from Greenwood, too. In ways he couldn't quite pinpoint except that Greenwood was home. Stapleton was a proper town, but the rest of the interior of Staten Island would be like this: farms, forest, wilderness. The next stop was in a village spread out around the train station like an apron, pretty, slightly tattered, and very quiet but for the huff of the train engine. A stand of tulip trees cast shade over the road, where a leggy girl in wooden clogs was herding a couple of goats along the road. The baby, balanced on her hip, had one small fist knotted in the sleeve of her dress. On the other side of the train tracks, orchards spread out. Apricot and plum and cherry in bloom, swaths of white and pink and red as far as he could see. The stops were 10 or 20 minutes apart, interrupted for long stretches for no apparent reason. Every station was simpler and smaller than the one before, with less of a village around it. The stretches of forest got longer, crab apples scattered between cedar and gum trees, their petals floating on the breeze. Passengers came and went, greeted each other, and talked in the way of people who knew each other's parents and grandparents, secrets and foibles. Anna slept through all of it, unaware. He had been told that Pleasant Plains was the stop closest to the new mission at Mount Loretto, but Jack bought tickets for Tottenville, two stops on, a more substantial village and the final train stop on the southernmost shore with another ferry station, this one with service to Perth Amboy in Jersey. In Tottenville, he hoped they would be able to find lunch and directions and a livery stable to rent a horse and trap, and then, finally, a hotel, if fate was kind. When the conductor came through calling out, "Tottenville, end of the line, Tottenville," Jack got some basic information. The name of a restaurant where they could get a good lunch, and when Jack mentioned they would be going to Mount Loretto, the news that Father McKinaway had gone to the city just this morning, traveling north to the ferry on this very train. He wouldn't be back for a couple of days, some kind of emergency at his mission of the Immaculate Virgin. But then, wasn't that always the way with those street Arabs? McKinaway was a saint, papist or not, and you couldn't convince Tom Bottoms any different. "There's nobody at Mount Loretto at all?" Jack asked. "D-
didn't say that, did I? The place is overrun with monkish types, you know, brown robes and bald spots.
He took off his hat to point to his own pate, shiny with perspiration.
They give themselves on purpose. Like a hive of worker bees, said the conductor. Work till they drop.
Walking to the inn for lunch, Anna wondered why she wasn't more upset. All this way for no good reason. Of course, they would still go to Mount Loretto and ask questions, but the chance of real progress seemed unlikely. They might just as well turn around and go back to the city. But neither of them raised the subject, and Anna was glad. The very idea made her head ache. The restaurant was more of a cafe, just a few tables and a lunch counter where older men hunched over coffee cups and slabs of pie. They got the last free table, one that overlooked the ferry terminal. Through windows polished to a high shine, Anna watched seagulls wheeling overhead, calling to each other in voices that had always struck her as forlorn, even in such bright weather.
"We can go to Mount Loretto this afternoon," Jack said, "and find a beach to walk on, after. Take a nap somewhere in the shade. Maybe I should write a thank you note to McKinaway for not being here."
Anna thought of saying what came to mind. Maybe it was time to give up. The Russo boys were gone. They could only hope to good families. But instead, the waitress came, and they ordered oyster stew, the freshest on the island, they were told, thick with potatoes and carrots all jumbled together in a silky broth, served over great rounds of delicate buttery pastry. "I can't eat all this," Anna said, and then proved herself wrong. She stopped just short of the last spoonful, which Jack was glad to finish off. And he was still hungry. That was obvious by the way he was sizing up the row of pies kept under glass domes. He ordered lemon meringue and offered her a taste on his fork, smooth and tart and sweet all at once. It was an oddly intimate thing to eat from the same fork. Anna let the pie rest on her tongue, enjoying the flavors and textures, and enjoying, too, the way Jack's eyes were fixed on her mouth, and then her throat as she swallowed. There was no sheen of perspiration on his skin, but she still thought there was a scent, maybe one that she alone could perceive. She was aware of the beat of her own pulse at her wrists, and at the base of her throat, and low in the very core of her being. They were almost finished when a cranky toddler sitting with his parents at the next table let out an impatient bellow and launched himself out of his chair, so abruptly that neither mother nor father had any chance of catching him. He hit the floor chin first and bounced to his feet like the 3-year-old rubber ball he was. For 1 second, there was silence all around, and then he realized that a sheet of blood was pouring off his chin. To Anna's ear, it was clear that he wasn't howling in pain, but outrage, to have been so thwarted. His parents, on the other hand, looked as though they might swoon. Anna got up.
"May I have a look? I'm a doctor."
And at their confused expressions, "A physician." At first, she thought they would send her away, outraged at such an obvious lie. Then common sense won out, and the young man with a face almost as smooth as his son's picked the boy up and thrust him into her arms. Anna sat down with the boy on her lap, angled so that he would bleed on his already ruined clothes rather than her own. "His name is Ernst," the mother offered, her hands fisted together as if she had to fight the urge to snatch him up and away. Jack had already brought her bag over and opened it for her, crouching beside it and waiting to hear what she might need.
"My goodness," she said to the little boy called Ernst, and pointed to an invisible spot on the floorboards. "Look at the hole you made in the floor. You must have a very hard head."
Startled, he stopped his wailing and considered the floor. While Anna blotted away the blood with a square of gauze, she talked to him in a calm voice, offering observations that made him forget how insulted he was supposed to be.
There, she said, gesturing to his parents to come closer. He's sprung a leak, but just a small one. No need for stitches. It just needs disinfecting and a plaster to keep it clean. Anna looked up and caught sight of Jack watching her, his expression open and frank and unmistakable. He really did love her. She had wanted to believe it. She had set herself the task of believing it. But now she saw it as clearly as she saw the face of the little boy in her arms, round cheeks and sea-green eyes still full of tears. Ernst looked at her solemnly and said,
I made a hole in the floor.
It was the waitress who warned them about Mr. Malone at the livery. He liked to nap in the early afternoon, and never in the same place.
Calling his name will do you no good, she said. On a good day, he's mostly deaf, and he hasn't had a good day in a year or more.
Now, Nell, someone called from the other side of the room. Don't be telling tales. Your old dad always shows up by two bells.
She laughed.
Me dad can't hear the bells. But, she admitted, Jack thought with some affection, he shouldn't be too long now.
Mr. Malone did appear in fairly short order, with wisps of hay in his sparse gray hair. Shouting, they managed well enough to rent a horse and trap. But by that time it was already 2:30, and they still didn't know exactly where they were going.
We'll have to go someplace else to ask directions, Jack said.
But Anna had other ideas. She produced a pencil and a piece of paper and put them on the counter in front of the old man. On it, she printed in clear letters, Please draw a map to Mount Loretto. You would have thought she had handed him a $100 bill, he was so pleased to be able to help. In 5 minutes, they had a decent map with roads marked. Anna gave the man a 50-cent piece, and he winked at her.
I was starting to think this whole undertaking was doomed, Anna said once they set off.
Jack bumped her with his shoulder.
Got to have more faith than that, Savard.
For a few minutes, the chestnut, young and up to tricks in the fine weather, demanded his full attention. And by the time he could look at Anna, she was focused on the view. He wondered what he had missed, because it seemed just then that she was holding back something she could not quite bring herself to say. But he wouldn't press, not on such a fine afternoon. They passed a small farmstead surrounded by dogwood and mountain laurel and trembling first blossom. Geese were busy looking for worms and slugs in a newly turned garden plot, stark white against the dark soil. Jack pointed out a stand of shrubby persimmon trees covered in waxy white blossoms, pinkster bloom azaleas, violas, and violets.
I couldn't name more than 3 of the hundreds of plants I'm seeing, Anna said. But to you, they all have personalities.
I suppose that's true, Jack said. My mother talks about plants that way, as if they had minds of their own.
Do you think she'll approve of me?
She asked the question lightly, but she was anxious, as Jack knew he would be anxious if her father were alive and unknown to him.
Yes, he said. I really think she will.
Even if I'm the cause of your sister's going home.
She'll love you all the more for that, Jack said. She'd like to have them home.
Anna hummed. He looked at her and saw an expression that was doubtful and suspicious both.
What if your sisters don't want to go back to Greenwood?
He said, Unmarried young women do not live alone. It's an unwritten but sacrosanct law in Italian families. If something should happen to one of them, it's the men in the family who are seen as having failed.
After a long and almost tense pause, she said, We would have room for them in the new house.
He heard himself draw in a sharp breath. You're not serious.
No, Anna admitted, but the possibility should be discussed at least.
They will make you crazy.
Maybe, Anna conceded.
But I am at work all day, and I don't have time to cook and clean. If they are willing to keep the house...
I don't want to share you with my sisters, Jack said. And we can afford a housekeeper.
They had had a frank discussion about money, earnings and savings and property. In return for surrendering his interest in the family farm, Jack had a share in the commercial end of the business in the city, which bolstered the modest salary he drew as a detective sergeant. Anna's father had liquidated his property in New Orleans long before the war. The estate had gone to her brother, and then it had come to her. If not for the 1873 panic and the depression that followed, they would be moderately wealthy. As it was, they were far better off than most of their generation. They wouldn't be building mansions on Fifth Avenue, but that would be true if they had as much money as the Astor and Vanderbilt families combined. They could afford a housekeeper, and they would need one. Of that, there was no question. She nodded in reluctant agreement.
The thing is, if they are forced back to Greenwood because of me, I'll never have a chance to win them over. What? She said. You look surprised.
I didn't think you ever worried about things like that. What people think of you.
Of course I do, Anna said. And then, while he held her gaze for a moment, well, all right, I might not worry about what a store clerk thinks about my boots, or what the district attorney thinks about my education, but this is your family we're talking about. Your mother, above all. I would like her to be happy for you. Which reminds me...
Jack tensed.
You must have had some pressure to marry before this point. Did they pick you out a wife?
As a matter of fact, Jack said, and it was Anna's turn to tense.
You can't be serious.
Let's just say that I've been introduced to a number of young women my mother took a liking to. All Italian, of course.
And Jewish?
He lowered his brow in thought.
Two of them were, if I remember correctly.
And you declined?
Of course I declined, Jack said. Did you think I had a wife squirreled away somewhere?
You didn't like any of them?
I liked them well enough.
Pretty?
Oh, no, Jack said. We're not going down that road.
Ha, Anna said. You opened the door, and I'm not going to let you shut it so quickly. So your mother...
Not just my mother. Aunts, cousins.
I see. So they found you a good Italian daughter, a pretty girl brought up to keep house and produce babies. So why do you think they'll approve of me?
Because they are my people, Jack said. Because they want me to be happy, and you make me happy. It's that simple.
She didn't want to smile, but she couldn't help herself.
Anna wondered in one part of her mind why she was pursuing such a difficult subject today, of all days. As a little girl, she had often provoked even gentle people to outbursts of frustration. Over the years, Aunt Quinlan had curbed this impulse so that, as an adult, she could resist, in most situations.
I'm being difficult, she said to Jack now, and I'm not sure why. I apologize for needling you.
Jack took this in with his usual calm expression. You're nervous about the Russo boy. If he is here, we could be taking him back to the city. Of course you're nervous.
That might be true if Father McKinaway were here, but he's not.
And Anna was grateful, but kept that to herself.
They came over a rise to see Mount Loretto, or what would one day soon be Mount Loretto, spread out before them. There were a half dozen buildings, some barely begun, others almost finished, set around a large square with the foundations of a brick building, most likely a church by its shape and size. Some dozen men were at work, all of them wearing rough brown robes. On the far side of the main development, more men were at work on a barn, while still more drove oxen as they turned under meadow.
Great piles of lumber and brick and shingles separated the clearing from a wood.
Monks, Jack said before she could ask the question. Franciscan. I think there's a monastery not too far away.
Look, it's right on the bay.
He pointed, and Anna saw the glint of sun on water through a stand of trees. This is a huge undertaking. It's overwhelming, Anna said.
The Catholic Church, Jack agreed. They move mountains when it suits them. Should we ask for a tour?
We've come this far, Anna said.
They were directed to one of the buildings that was almost finished, with a makeshift office on the ground floor. One wall of shelves was already filled with overstuffed binders, all neatly labeled. Under a single window, a desk was heaped with file folders and correspondence boxes. A thick wad of receipts and bills of lading and orders had been threaded into a long nail driven through a block of wood. A small jug held pencil stubs and a few pens, the nibs in clear need of attention. In the middle of the room, a monk leaned over a table where a set of architectural drawings had been rolled out and secured with bricks. He was making notations with a pencil, working with his nose almost pressed to the paper. He looked up at the sound of Jack's knock, his expression friendly and welcoming. Anna let Jack handle the introductions because she was never sure of the proper protocol in such circumstances, but she was sure that the protocol was important to getting the discussion off on the right foot.
You aren't the first callers to go away disappointed today, he was saying to Jack. I'm very sorry that you've come so far for no good reason.
Brother Jeremy struck her as a no-nonsense, well-intentioned sort, and she was inclined to believe that he meant what he said. He was well over 50, with short iron-gray hair and a sunburned nose, wide in the shoulder with great square hands that were stained with ink and paint both. He reminded her of Uncle Quinlan, she realized suddenly, but could not put her finger on why that might be. Jack pulled out their single ace.
It was Sister Irene at the Foundling who suggested we talk to Father McKinaway.
Ah, Sister Irene, said Brother Jeremy. You've left no stone unturned. I can only wish you better luck with your next visit. Now, may I give you a short tour?
It was not unexpected, but Anna still struggled with disappointment as they walked the property with Brother Jeremy. They saw buildings that would serve as dormitories, looked at classrooms and workrooms and washrooms and offices. There was a very large kitchen where 10 people could work side by side, and an attached dining hall. There was an infirmary, as yet nothing more than walls, with plumbing in place. It seemed to Anna that any boy who had been living on the streets of the city, unsure of even the next day's meal, must be content here. At the very least, he would be warm and fed, and he would learn to read and write and a trade, too, Brother Jeremy assured them.
Carpentry, tool-making, sail-making, farming. Any boy who shows a calling will be sent to a seminary when he's old enough.
Anna swallowed that fact without comment and felt Jack relax beside her. Brother Jeremy said,
You might like to walk along the bay while you're here. We'll water and graze your horse while you're gone, if you like.
Jack offered Anna his arm, and they set off through a small wood full of birdsong and trees in new leaf. A flickering of yellow caught Anna's eye. Had Jack seen it? A warbler, he thought from the song. High in a tree was a pure white owl, and nearby, a woodpecker hard at work. They were quiet, and Anna wondered if things would be awkward now that they had only each other to deal with. That thought was still in her mind when they came out on a narrow footpath that wound through brush and shrubs. It struck her like a drawing out of a children's adventure story, and the idea made her pick up her pace. Jack let out a small laugh, one that told her he was just as intrigued. Together, they followed the path until it brought them to a narrow marsh where someone had put a wide board down to serve as a bridge. And beyond that point, the grasses began to fall away, showing up spottily on the swells of sand that blocked their view of the beach. Birds were everywhere, but Jack was almost as clueless as Anna about their names. Long-legged, knobby-kneed birds with narrow, arched beaks like scimitars stood in the marsh waters where ducks with different markings and colors were busy among the reeds. The sound of great wings beating in the air made Anna look up to see a bird as big as a man, or so it seemed, heading away from the bay with a fish in its talons. A falcon? An eagle? She had no idea and felt the lack. She could name every bone and muscle in the human body, but she had no idea what to call the small brown birds with white bellies that strutted along like little old men. They climbed the ridge of sand and found the ocean spread out before them. The water was deep blue and choppy, tumbling white-combed waves catching sunlight so bright that tears sprang to Anna's eyes despite her broad-brimmed straw hat. There were boats on the horizon, too small to make out, and a little ways down the beach, a small group of people were gathered around a picnic basket.
Over there.
Jack inclined his head toward a protected spot overhung by a stand of tall bushes. They made themselves comfortable despite the fact that they were both dressed to pay a call on a priest. Jack took off his jacket and spread it over a bush, but there was nothing Anna could shed. She was wearing her favorite summer walking dress with a shirt waist of fine batiste, pleated from the shoulders and embroidered along the neckline, and most important, completely out of fashion, because the sleeves were cut wide to give her freedom of movement. She spread the skirts around herself, layers of silk charmeuse and dimity that caught the breeze and lifted up to reveal her stockings and shoes. Her half-boots were kid leather and practical for walking, but Rosa had insisted on lacing them with pale green ribbons to match her stockings. When we were little, Aunt Quinlan would take us to visit a friend who lived on Long Island, and we ran half-naked on the beaches all day long. It was heaven. Jack looked over his shoulder at the family with the picnic basket.
That I would like to see.
Unlikely, Anna said, unless you can find a beach like Robinson Crusoe's.
You were happy here, as a child?
Anna considered. After my parents died, Aunt Quinlan dedicated herself to me and to Sophie when she came. She would have nothing less than our happiness. She stopped herself. Tell me about when you were young. Did you swim?
Greenwood, he told her, was a good place to raise children. There had been a lot of hard work in the fields and greenhouses and among the beehives, but they were free to roam when their chores were done. There was a stream overhung by trees and a small lake, and they swam in high summer at every opportunity.
While he talked, they watched the small family, and in particular the antics of a little girl who capered around them. The sound of her voice came to them in snatches on the wind, high and laughing. All at once, she let out a screech of delight and hightailed it for the water. A man, her father, Anna guessed, chased after her, roaring in mock pursuit. They were both wearing bathing costumes of bright red fabric, and they stood out against the sand like candle flames. He picked the little girl up and held her over his head, straight-armed, while he stalked into the water, where he threatened and she cajoled, and then, finally, where he dropped her. Sputtering, she jumped out of the shallow water and ran for her mother and a towel.
That's a good lesson for a girl her age, Anna said. Be prepared to reap what you sow. I always detested girls who screamed no when they really meant yes.
But Jack seemed not to hear her. He was still studying the little family, something odd in his expression. Anna said, "What is it? Do you know them?"
"No, I don't think so."
He stood up, retrieved his coat, and hung it over his shoulder by one crooked finger.
We should probably get back to town. The last train is at 4, or we will have to find a hotel room.
The decision had been hanging over her head for days, even weeks, and now it could be avoided no longer. She could do the simplest and most conventional thing and go back to the city to sleep in her own room. Or they could stay here, together, in a single hotel room, with no one to interrupt or distract them. Anna believed that she was free of most of the restrictions society put on young women. Here was the real test.
Will we register as husband and wife?
If we want one room, yes. They are likely to refuse us otherwise. What part of it makes you uncomfortable?
I should be able to rent a hotel room without lying, Anna said. It's no one's business but my own.
Ah, well, Jack said, there the good citizens of New York disagree with you. There are all kinds of laws on the books about what goes on behind closed doors.
And you enforce them?
Not if I can help it. Not unless someone is being harmed.
I would like to stay here, Anna said, so we can present ourselves as a married couple if we must.
If you're sure.
That got her a half smile.
I'm more than sure.
Then why the serious face?
He hesitated, then shook his head. I had an odd idea, but I don't want to go into it right now.
Anna was brushing the sand from her skirts, but noticed that Jack had turned his attention away again.
Let's go this way, he said, and held out her hand.
The father and daughter had wrapped themselves in towels and settled down with the rest of the family when Anna and Jack approached. A family like a million others, father, mother, an elderly woman who would be a grandmother, the little girl, and a babe in arms, swaddled in layers of linen and cotton, with a white lace cap on its head.
Good afternoon,
the father called over the noise of the waves and the gulls. Anna turned to return the greeting and stopped. The little girl was crouching in front of her mother, kissing the baby's cheek with all the affection a very young girl could bring to the task. Anna was reminded of Leah, though this girl was blonde and fair-skinned. She must have felt Anna's gaze, because she looked up and then lurched herself toward them, bouncing with every step.
I am Teresa Ann Mullen, and I have a baby brother, she said, pronouncing each word carefully. His name is Timothy Seamus Mullen. Do you want to see him?
Somehow Anna knew, even before the young mother turned the baby in her arms to show him off. She knew what she would see. A child of about 5 months, with very dark hair that curled and eyes the color of the cloudless sky overhead. For a moment, she could make no sound at all, and finally her voice came rough.
Hello, she said. What beautiful children you have, Mrs. Mullen. Truly beautiful.
The young woman smiled shyly and murmured her thanks.
Will you sit and take something to drink?
Her husband asked. He had a deep, almost melodious voice, as purely Irish as Anna had ever heard.
You are very kind to ask.
Jack took her elbow.
But we do need to get back to town.
They walked in an arc back toward Mount Loretto. As they crested the low sand dunes, a cottage came into sight. It was surrounded by trees and a pasture where cows and a few horses grazed.
Do you think, Anna asked, is this where they live?
Very likely, Jack said. They couldn't have walked very far with everything they had with them.
They didn't talk again until they had gotten back to the building site, reclaimed the horse and trap, and set out for the town.
I wasn't sure, Jack said. I just caught a glimpse of his head. You think it's him?
Yes. She had known him almost immediately. When she first saw Vittorio in Hoboken, he had been in Rosa's arms. A strong child who held up his head and turned toward the sound of his sister's voice, kicked vigorously and produced a wide, toothless smile, all signs of timely development. 2 months is an eternity in the life of an infant. Vittorio Russo is almost twice the age he was when I examined him in Hoboken. But yes, I think it is him. The coloring is distinctive, and it's hard to overlook the fact that this family lives so near Mount Loreto.
The father had blue eyes, Jack said.
Did he?
And he was fair-haired. They all were.
It's unlikely that they would produce a dark-haired child, then,
Jack said. Is there a way to find out for sure, beyond asking Father McKinaway?
They were silent for a few minutes as the horse picked up its pace. Horses wanted to get home as much as people did, Mr. Lee had told her once. We could talk to the parents, Anna said finally.
No, we can't, Jack said easily.
And he was right. Approaching the family was to be avoided at all costs. They would take offense or feel threatened or both, and not without cause. Anna said, I wonder who delivers children here, if there's a midwife or a doctor.
I think Nell is probably the better prospect, Jack said.
Nell? And then Anna remembered, the waitress at the cafe. You're right, I think. She spends all day watching people come and go. But the cafe isn't open in the evening.
If they stayed overnight, they could talk to Nell over breakfast.
Anna found she didn't have the courage to make such a suggestion. They returned the horse and trap to a cheerful Mr. James Malone, who had been joined by a Michael Malone, the very image of his father and far more talkative. While the men discussed horses and the weather, Jack was working his way around to asking about a hotel, she was sure. Anna wandered away to read notices nailed to the wall of the livery. Livestock for sale. Someone hoping to buy a second-hand plow. A lost dog. A bosun open for business. A respectable lady who did laundry at a very reasonable rate. There were notices of church services in Perth Amboy. First Presbyterian, United Methodists, St. Peter's Episcopal, Second Baptists, and St. Mary's Catholic. She wondered if Mount Loreto's church would serve the community, too. There seemed to be a large Irish population. On the notices, she saw a scattering of German names, but many more, like Ryan, McCarthy, O'Neill, Daly, Duffy, and O'Shea. Jack came up behind her.
Let's go for a walk.
Tottenville was more a village than a town, but a growing one and well-kept. The sidewalks swept, gutters cleaned, and display windows free of grime. They passed a dry goods store, a grocer, a barber shop, all doing a lot of business on a late Saturday afternoon.
Here's the doctor you were wondering about.
Jack inclined his head to a shingle that hung on the gate of a substantial house. Dr. Nelson Drake was responsible for the health and well-being of this pretty town at the southernmost point of New York State, and he seemed to be prospering. Just across from the doctor was the town court and post office, still open for business, and beyond that, the Tottenville Hotel. A block farther on, they found a smithy with a sign nailed to the outside wall. Amon Mullen, General Blacksmithing, Horseshoeing, Plow and Woodwork. The wide doors were shut and the window shuttered. No sign of life anywhere. They had come to the end of the little street, where they found a bench that looked out over a small wilderness, and beyond that, the sea. We don't even know if it's the same Mullen, Anna said. Jack covered her hand with his own.
It's harder now, isn't it? Seeing him with a family. He looked healthy,
Yes, Anna agreed. He looked healthy and well-loved. And the older sister, too. No lack of nourishment or attention.
Why would they have adopted?
Jack asked. Anna thought back over all the women she had cared for. The ones who were desperate to have children, and those who were terrified by the idea. Almost every woman she knew had a story of a mother or sister or aunt who had died giving birth or shortly thereafter, or who had lost one child after another. There were women who grew shells that allowed them to survive such losses, and others who broke under the weight.
She might have lost a child, Anna said, or she can't conceive. That's not uncommon.
Was the daughter adopted too, do you think?
Anna was surprised by the question, which hadn't occurred to her.
She could be, I suppose.
There's no way really to know, and if she is, it's likely she hasn't been told and never will be. Most people who adopt seem to want it that way.
Jack pushed out his legs and crossed them at the ankle.
Italians don't think like that, he said. We pass children around like pieces on a chessboard.
Anna hiccuped a laugh. What does that mean? He shrugged.
One family has too many kids. The sister-in-law has none. They share the wealth, so to speak. Send over some kids to be raised in that household. But it's never kept a secret. In small villages, that would be impossible. And even in a city, I can't imagine it.
Your parents never thought to send one of you back to Italy to be raised by an aunt or uncle? Too late, Anna remembered the reason the Mezzanotes had left Italy, but Jack wasn't disturbed.
They did send me back, he said. They just waited until I was old enough to stand up for myself to do it.
Anna shifted to look at him directly. Do you mean in regard to religion? Because of the way the families reacted to your parents' marriage?
In part. When I left for Italy, they both warned me not to let the older relatives play tug-of-war with me.
Did they do that? Try to win you over to one side or the other? He gave her a solemn look.
You can't imagine the things Italian women will compete for. But I made my position clear right at the start, and after that they kind of lost heart, I suppose. I took the fun out of the battle for my soul.
You know, Anna said, you've never told me where you stand. Do you consider yourself Jewish?
Judaism is matrilineal. So, whatever I consider myself, my mother's family sees me as Jewish. But here's how it worked when I was a kid. Our parents sat us down and told us the whole story, and then they stood back. It was up to each of us to decide for ourselves. Two of my brothers married Jewish women, and the others married Roman Catholics. Some of them observe the Sabbath, some of them go to church. I can never remember who does what.
You are still evading the question, Anna said.
I thought it would be clear by now. I haven't taken a side, and I don't plan to. I'm happy floating in uncharted waters. I'm the odd one out in the family, not cut out for the farm, too smart for my own good. So they sent me to Italy to study law.
We may need a lawyer before this is all resolved, Anna said after a long moment. What do you think we should do about the baby?
Would you want to claim him?
Anna tried to gather her thoughts, but they refused to order themselves. It wasn't the boy she was thinking about, but his mother. The woman who had become his mother, holding him up for the world to admire. Her expression had been serene and utterly calm, as if she had no other purpose but to care for the children gathered to her.
They haven't done anything wrong, Jack said.
Anna glanced at him sharply. I never said they had. If it is him, they took in an orphan to raise as their own.
Not wanting to give him up wouldn't be wrong either, Jack said. He's been with that family for 2 months. Would he have any memory of his real mother, of Rosa or Leah or Tonino?
No, Anna said. Or at least, I've never seen any evidence of that. He's well cared for by kind and loving people, and that's his universe. The only life he knows. Would we have to approach Father McKinaway as a first step?
I think that would be the best way, Jack said, if we want to go that route.
So not this weekend, then?
No.
We can take a few days to think it all through and talk to Aunt Quinlan, but not to the girls, Jack said.
That's a sensible plan.
Not talk to the girls yet, Anna amended. Jack put a hand on the nape of her neck and rocked her head gently back and forth. For a few long minutes, they just sat. And then Jack cleared his throat. It was a sound Anna knew. He had something to suggest he thought she might not like, something important. She was trying to remember the last time she had heard him make this sound, and it had just come to her. The afternoon he broke the news about buying the old Greber place, when he took her hand. He said,
I think we should get married.
Surprised, Anna looked at him. Haven't we already agreed to do that?
He gave a small shake of the head. I think we should get married today. Right now. By the justice of the peace at the courthouse we just passed.
Is this about the hotel room? Anna said. Because if we want to stay overnight, I'm not so very uncomfortable about registering.
No, Jack said. It's not about that. Did you want a big wedding?
Anna had to clear her own throat. No. Really, no.
Well, Jack said, smiling. It's one way to celebrate your birthday. Why not?
She studied his expression. Is this about the Russo baby? About talking to Father McKinaway? That made him laugh. He cupped her face in both hands and kissed her. A simple, chaste kiss.
Father McKinaway is about the furthest thing from my mind. This isn't about Sophie and Cap or the inquest or anything but me wanting to marry you. Today. I'm tired of waiting. I want to go to sleep with you and wake up with you. Starting today.
It's a little more complicated than that, Jack. Where would we live? I can't move out of the house just when Sophie's going. It would be terribly disruptive to the girls and Aunt Quinlan, all of them.
I see that. But I could move in, just until Weeds is ready.
Anna knew that her mouth was hanging open. And more than that, she could see that Jack was pleased with her, because she hadn't refused, out of hand, because she was thinking about it. Because she was thinking about it. Then something occurred to her. Your sisters, your mother, they won't be offended at being left out?
My mother, no. She's practical. As far as my sisters are concerned, they are so wound up in transforming Weeds that they won't much care. Really, think about it, Anna. It's the best part. With my sisters so busy with the house, they'll point-blank refuse to go home to Greenwood, and Mama will see the logic in letting them finish. Maybe by the time Weeds is ready, everybody will be comfortable with the idea of them staying in the city.
Anna put a hand over her mouth to keep herself from laughing out loud.
Can you come up with any real objections?
Slowly, she shook her head. Jack peeled her hand away from her face, kissed the palm, and held on to it.
Savard, if you're not ready, all you have to do is say those three words. I'm not ready.
Anna's voice cracked. What about Monday? The inquest? Will it complicate things?
Just the opposite, Jack said. Nobody will be able to challenge my place next to you.
In theory, I could end up in prison, Anna said. If Comstock has his way, that's exactly what will happen. Jack studied their linked hands for a moment.
and then he gave her an even, calculating look.
There are people working on your behalf this weekend.
That's an oddly momentous statement. I do trust Conrad, but
Oscar is hard at work, too.
That gave her pause. Oscar?
If they want to send somebody to prison, it's going to be the person who did Janine Campbell harm.
Jack, Anna said, I appreciate Oscar's help, but it's entirely possible that she acted alone, without any assistance.
Maybe so, Jack said. But Oscar is tracking her movements for the days before she died. I can pretty much guarantee that. If she saw no one out of the ordinary and no one out of the ordinary came to see her, if Oscar can account for all of your time in the last week, that will be the end of the matter. As far as your connection, of course.
Anna drew in a very deep breath and held it. She could see a half dozen ways this plan might fail, but then again, it might succeed.
So, can you put that worry out of your mind for the rest of the weekend?
I suppose I must, Anna said. She stood, but he stayed where he was, looking up at her. Are you coming? She said. They may have already closed the town hall for the day. And then what? In fact, the justice of the peace was almost out the door when they found him. He had already put an old-fashioned stovepipe hat on his perfectly bald head and was standing in the doorway. He looked at them over the top of his spectacles with what could only be called suspicion. Before Jack had said five words, the man turned his back on them and went back into his office, leaving the door open. Jack ushered her inside, following closely. The man who had taken a seat behind the desk was Theodore Baugh, Esquire, according to the placard on his desk. He gestured to two chairs, and they sat. Anna wondered if the man would ever speak, and whether she should be nervous about the way he was studying her. Before she could think of something to say that wouldn't sound silly or inappropriate, the man put both hands on his desk and leaned forward a little.
Witnesses? Jack said, I'll go ask the clerk down the hall. The clerk down the hall? In a hurry, I see.
He didn't ask why they were in a hurry, and Jack didn't volunteer any information. Anna was starting to enjoy herself, though she wasn't sure why. Justice Baugh pursed his lips thoughtfully, then pointed to something on the wall behind them. Anna and Jack both turned to see a carefully lettered proverb in a simple black frame. Marry in haste, repent at leisure. A full minute passed while they sat silently, being studied. Anna thought of oral exams in front of a row of professors, grim or bored or encouraging, but she was willing to leave all this to Jack. Somehow, she knew that he would not speak first, that he had taken the justice of the peace at face value and accepted a challenge of sorts. She was really quite curious about how the impasse would end. Another minute passed. With a sigh, Justice Baugh got up from his chair, walked around the desk to the door, and opened it. His voice boomed down the hall.
Mr. Macklin, Mr. Reynolds, I need you down here right away.
Anna whispered to Jack. Is he sending for the constables to arrest us, do you think? Jack's mouth quirked at the corner. When Justice Baugh returned to his desk chair, he drew a piece of paper toward himself, took the cork from a bottle of ink, and picked up his pen. He looked at Jack.
Name?
By the time he had finished making a record of Jack's name, profession, age, place of birth and residence, and the names and birthplaces of his parents, two young men had come into the office. Baugh ignored them as he turned to Anna. My name is Liliane Mathilde Savard. I am a physician and surgeon, and today is my 28th birthday. I was born in Paradise, Hamilton County, New York, and I live at number 18 Waverly Place in the city. My father was Dr. Henry de Guise Savard, born in New Orleans. My mother was also a physician.
Curiosity Bonner Savard, born in Paradise, Hamilton County, New York. Justice Bow's eyebrows had climbed his forehead while she talked, but he didn't challenge her. Anna decided that she liked him.
Either of you have any legal impediments to this marriage?
When they assured him they did not, he scribbled something on his paper and without looking up said,
$5 for the marriage license, $5 for the civil ceremony.
It seemed that Jack had anticipated this much, because he put the money on the desk without looking for his wallet. The bills disappeared into Justice Bow's desk drawer with amazing speed. Then he looked at them over his spectacles one more time, and his whole face split into a smile. 15 minutes later, they left Justice Bow's office. In his hand, Jack held the marriage license and certificate, ink just barely dry, and regarded them as if he had never seen paper before in his life.
Here, Anna said, gesturing for them. I have a folio in my bag.
Her hands were trembling a little as she tucked the documents away, but the sight of her own signature, strong and clear, gave her back her equilibrium. They had married in haste, it was true, but they had also married out of affection and common interests and love. Even if she had yet to say the word, it was true. When she straightened again, he was smiling down at her.
Here we are, he said. Married.
So it seems. Now what?
Now we check into the hotel and find some dinner.
The first raindrops fell as they started down the street, and so they ran the rest of the way and stopped under the portico just as the sky opened up in earnest. The smell of rain hitting earth and cobblestones warm from the sun rose around them, the sweetest of perfumes. Jack opened the door and looked at her quizzically.
What are you thinking?
I hope it rains all night, she said. I love this. I love...
She swallowed.
I love summer rain.
He bent down and kissed the corner of her mouth. Against her ear, he said,
I love you too, Anna Savard.
They ate an early supper in the hotel restaurant, a thick broth full of wide noodles, roasted lamb and buttery mashed turnips, the first salad greens of the season, and marinated mushrooms. In between courses, they talked about the practical matters they had so studiously avoided before stepping into Justice Bow's office.
I should send a telegram to Aunt Quinlan, and one to Cap and Sophie, too. Do you want to send one to your sisters?
The corner of his mouth jerked.
Now that would offend my mother if she heard the news after my sisters.
We could go to Greenwood tomorrow, Anna said. If we took the ferry to Perth Amboy, we could find transportation from there, no?
That would be better than a telegram.
As soon as the words left her mouth, Anna wished she could call them back. The idea of adding a trip to Greenwood had come to her out of a sense of propriety, but it also filled her with dread.
Jack saw all that on her face, and in that moment, Anna forgave him for his frustrating talent for reading her mind.
Anna, he said, we've got a one-day honeymoon, and I'll be damned if we'll spend it anywhere but in bed.
The blossoming of heat on her throat and cheeks made him laugh, and Anna decided she could forgive him for that, too. Anna watched for a while as Jack worked on the telegrams for his parents and sisters, his usually confident hand pausing over each word. Just at this moment, she was glad she didn't speak Italian, though at some point she would want to know what he had written. She had never heard him speaking to his parents and had no idea if he would be deferential or self-assertive. Italians, she had come to understand, could be terribly formal in certain situations. He had written a telegram for Oscar, too, but it was tucked under the others, and Anna had the idea that she should leave well enough alone. Better not to hover. She made another tour of the room and stopped to watch the storm. The rain was moving across the bay in long, sinuous strokes that shimmered in the half-light. She shivered a little, but didn't bother to dig the shawl out of her valise. This kind of shivering was not about the chill in the air, but her nerves. The room was well-kept and comfortable, with a dresser, a divan, a desk, and a good wide bed with a thick comforter that would be welcome in the cool night salt air. The innkeeper himself had come to bring them a pitcher of fresh water for the washstand and to lay a fire in the grate, nodding toward the window and the rain in explanation. When he had gone, and Jack was still bent over the telegram form on the desk, Anna found herself yawning. She stretched out on the divan and let herself be seduced by the falling rain, drifting into sleep, only to wake with a start sometime later when lightning streaked across the sky. A blanket had been draped over her, light and warm. The room was lit only by the trembling touch of lightning and the fire in the hearth. Jack was nowhere to be seen. Most likely, he had gone off to arrange for the telegrams to be sent first thing in the morning. Maybe he had even told her he was going to do that, thinking she was awake, and in fact, there had been some vague dream in which she was sitting in front of the coroner with a telegram in her hand. She read it out loud. Just 5 words. Janine Campbell, stop, stop, stop. All day she had been successfully forbidding herself to dwell on Monday's inquest, but it had found a back door into her waking mind. The Russo boy had been in the dream too, sleeping in the arms of a faceless woman. She got up now and used the water closet and wash basin, and in short order she unpacked her valise and set out the few things she required. The day had been too long and too full of surprises, and she was exhausted. And where had Jack gotten to, anyway? She cleaned her teeth and let her hair down, foregoing her usual braid because Jack liked her hair unbound. When she was changed and ready for bed, she got out the medical journal she had brought along, in case she had time to read, and made herself comfortable. Jack meant to be away for just a few minutes. But the hotel clerk was in no hurry at all. Just the opposite. He counted and recounted every word on all 5 Western Union telegram forms, frowning deeply at the Italian.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I don't speak this language, whatever it is." "It's Italian, and you don't need to speak it," Jack said. "Count the words as you would English. I've printed very carefully. The telegraph clerk shouldn't have any problem."
"Aubrey doesn't speak anything but English either," the young man said.
"He doesn't need to," Jack said again. "Any competent telegraph clerk could handle this. Is Aubrey around? Maybe I should talk to him directly."
Aubrey wasn't available, but he could be fetched if Jack would like to come back in an hour. Jack would not. The conscientious, fastidious, and frustrating clerk turned back to his study of the telegrams. He pointed with his stub of pencil.
"If you take out this word, and these, and this one, you'll save..."
"I want to send them exactly as they are," Jack said.
The young man mumbled to himself as he labored over the short column of figures, adding them 3 times while Jack fumed silently to himself. Then it turned out that there wasn't enough change in the cash drawer. If the detective sergeant would wait, Jack would not. He assured the clerk that morning would be soon enough to collect his change, and left before the young man could find something else that needed counting. Every once in a while, he came across a person who was determined to demonstrate how seriously they regarded the law, as if Jack were watching closely for an excuse to make an arrest. He took the stairs 2 at a time, stopping to say good evening to a startled older couple with a teenage daughter, and arrived at the door of the room some 15 minutes later than he had hoped.
"Mezzanotte," he told himself. "You are behaving like a 16-year-old. Snap to."
With a deep breath, he opened the door. By the light of the fire, he made out her shape in the bed, a small form under the blankets. She was asleep, with a journal open under her hands. Her color was high, from scrubbing or the day's exercise or the breeze from the window she had cracked open. A heart-shaped face with strong dark brows and deep-set eyes, and a wide mouth the color of raspberries just coming into full ripeness. He saw all this and more, but he must keep it to himself. She simply could not tolerate praise, and always found a reason to walk away or change the subject. Jack took a moment to consider. There was a nightshirt at the very bottom of his valise, along with a face cloth and toothbrush. He didn't want to wake her, not just yet. He made some tactical decisions. Anna woke when Jack slipped into bed. 6 feet 4 inches of naked male, radiating heat like a giant and very prickly hot water bottle. His head propped on one hand, he was leaning over her to study the open journal page.
You know, I'm sure that clinical observations on tracheal tubes by mouth instead of...
Tracheostomy, she supplied.
Tracheostomy, Jack echoed,
drawing the journal away and dropping it behind him so it fluttered to the floor.
Exactly, that interesting topic can wait.
Forever, she finished, grinning so broadly that her cheeks began to ache. She rolled over onto her side to face him.
Where have you been?
Did you think I hopped a ferry?
She pressed her forehead under his chin and against his throat, shaking her head because she knew her voice would wobble. And how could she be expected to put together a single sentence while his fingers hooked into her nightdress and skimmed up her leg? He tugged, and she lifted and turned and shivered as the fabric dragged over her skin inch by inch until it snagged.
There's a button caught in your hair. Hold still.
His arms came around her head as his fingers threaded through individual strands of hair, pulling gently one by one so that goose flesh ran up and down her spine. His breath was warm on her scalp, and she shivered and shivered and shivered.
You're not cold.
His tone was almost accusatory. Not cold, she agreed. He pulled the nightdress up and off, and it disappeared behind him to join the medical journal on the floor.
So now that we're finally here, he said,
his arms slipping around her waist to pull her close,
what should we do with ourselves?
They lay face to face in the shadowy cave of white sheets, damp-skinned, swathed in each other's heat. Quiet but alert, both of them. Anna had the idea that she could hear his heart beating, just as she saw it in the throbbing pulse at his throat and temples. She leaned forward to draw in his scent just there, burrowing into his hair. She said, "The smell of you puts me in a trance." When she pulled away, he raised a hand to touch her face. His fingers were long and thick and strong, big-knuckled with blunt square fingertips, clean nails cut to the quick. She would never have thought that a man's hands could arouse so much feeling, but nerves fired all along her spine at the simple sight of him holding a newspaper or a fork, lifting a valise, unbuttoning a shirt. He cupped her face with one palm, threaded his fingers into her hair and pulled her close, lingering for a heartbeat, their mouths almost touching. Anna felt him draw in a deeper breath, as if his lungs were suddenly too small. She closed the distance between them, opened her mouth against his, and let herself be drawn down and down into a kiss that rendered her limp, soft and open and welcoming, pressing against him from knee to belly to breast to mouth, where he stroked her tongue with his own and called up her response, small murmurs and gasps. He took over. She found herself on her back, with his weight suspended over her so that she still felt every tensed muscle, the hard planes of his thighs and belly, and between them the evidence that he wanted her. He was turgid, arching, weeping, the broad head of his erection seeking blindly, tapping against her belly. "Come," she said. "Come to me." He made a clucking noise. Mock surprise and male satisfaction rolled into one.
So impatient.
And he slipped down to press his face to the curve of her breast.
"We have all night,"
he mumbled against her skin.
"What's the hurry?"
She shook her head and laughed and gave in, arching to rub against him, running a heel down his thigh through rough hair, and then stopping when he drew her nipple deep into his mouth and suckled. The hot pull distracted her so that she didn't realize they were moving until they sat, face to face, Jack on his knees, her legs spread wide over his hips, his hands tangled in the hair that cascaded down her back, holding her just so while he drew hard at her breast, suckled and suckled until she groaned, flexing against him, stretched open and wet. She reached for him, but he blocked one hand and then the other, gathering them behind her to keep them at the small of her back as efficiently as handcuffs. It went against the grain, and he knew it, knew she'd struggle and resist, and that she'd stop, as she did, as he used his free hand to fit himself to her. Anna dropped her head to watch it happen. She wanted to rock against him in welcome, to drag him in and then retreat so that he must follow. But he knew her game. He held her and moved her exactly as he wanted, entering her with excruciating, exacting intention. He penetrated mind and heart and body, insisting that she give in and take all of him, everything he had to offer. When she thought there was no more to surrender, he still inched forward, crooning at her, "Come and come and come to me." Finally, he released his grip on her wrists and cupped her buttocks in his hand to lift her just so. His mouth grazed her jaw, suckled at her earlobe. He whispered to her, "I fill you up." She pulsed and strained against him, took his mouth and the kiss she wanted as he began to rock into her, deep and deeper still. She began to shudder, coming undone by the simple fact of him. Joined at the quick, for once and always. Chapter 25. Western Union. Tottenville, Staten Island, New York. District Telegraph Office XUS23S902JD. Sunday, May 27th, 1883, 7 a.m. Mrs. Lily Quinlan, Mrs. Margaret Cooper, Mr. and Mrs. Lee, Rosa and Leah Russo, 18 Waverly Place, New York, New York. Dearest all, we were married Saturday afternoon in Tottenville, Staten Island. Shockingly spontaneous behavior, but we are very pleased with ourselves. Hope there is room for us both at Rose's until Weeds is ready. We'll be back later today after seeing Sophie and Cap and Jack's sisters. Hope to be there by 6. Please, no party until resolution of inquest. Love to you all, Anna and Jack. Western Union, Tottenville, Staten Island, New York, District Telegraph Office XUS23S902JD. Sunday, May 27th, 1883, 7:10 a.m. Mr. Peter Verhoeven, Esquire, and Dr. Sophie Savard Verhoeven, 40 Park Place, New York, New York. Dearest Sophie and Cap, we tried to wait out the impulse, but have happily succumbed to a revolutionary mindset and followed you into matrimony here in Tottenville, Staten Island. Plan to return on the 3 o'clock ferry and will come straight to Park Place to talk. With all our love, Anna and Jack. Western Union, Tottenville, Staten Island, New York. District Telegraph Office XUS23S902JD, Sunday, May 27th, 1883, 7:15 a.m. Detective Sergeant Oscar Maroney, 86 Grove Street, New York, New York.